welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, your host for this exciting radio program today, where we're going to have on Dr. Stephen Lam, and he is a longtime advocate of moving from intervention to prevention. And he's going to be talking about his three-step plan he calls the Gut Solution, and his fabulous book, No Guts, No Glory. This is, the idea is this, is you are what you absorb, you are what's going on inside your intestine, you have more probiotics and dysbiotics, I guess the disordered ones, in your intestine than even cells in your body. So it has to make a big deal, and we have great-great-grandfathers like Eli Metchnikoff that also stated these things. But now we're kind of entering into a realm where science is figuring out what's going on in the gut and why it's so important for our health, even for weight. And we have the author of the book, No Guts, No Glory, Dr. Stephen Lam. Am I saying your name right, Stephen?
Not only did you say my name right, but you basically summarized the book.
as a naturopath, we've been steeped in this stuff, and it was the foundations of naturopathic care way before it even became pretty fashionable in mainstream medicine to be talking about probiotics and your gut and you are what you eat and the 4R program and you are what you absorb and all these kind of. I should make a cool T-shirt out of that. These are kind of our aphorisms that are the foundation of functional medicine. So tell us
I think what's happened is that, the medical, the traditional medical profession, and I am the traditional medical
profession. You mean the conventional, not traditional.
Yeah, you're right, conventional.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
I'm thinking tradition is like,
tradition is
like Chinese medicine.
Yeah, no, you're
like
absolutely right. No.
Yeah.
When I say traditional, it's my tradition.
Right.
And it's conventional. I'm a professor at the medical school, and we teach physiology and biology and disease management. And I think, what happened, we got really caught up with our ability, quote, to treat a lot of different diseases. And, we have effective treatment for blood pressure and cholesterol and, whatever you have, we can give you a drug and change the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But, the reality was that I wasn't really changing necessarily the course of illness or the state of wellness of the patient. And progressively over the last 25, 30 years, that became a little bit more important to me. And, for example, I've written several books on Viagra, so I'm considered one of the real experts in erectile dysfunction. But what about erectile function? What is optimum function? Well, we know what ulcers are like. We know what colitis is like. But what is optimum GI function? It's not the disease state that I'm looking at, but the wellness state, and how do we improve that? And then it became clear to me that at least, and I like all the organ systems in the body. I mean, I love the lungs or the kidneys or the heart or the brain, but, the one system that seems to have been pretty much maligned by most of us in our society, really the gut, to the point that we don't even know how to define it. You do. But, and maybe your listeners do, but, the average person will come in and tell me that their stomach hurts and they're pointing to the right lower part of their belly or their left lower, So it's a system that it became very clear to me that maybe the center of wellness may actually start, in the gut, because the basic principles are you're as healthy as the foods you absorb, the nutrient value of the foods, and what is the organ system that does it? It's your gut.
Yeah.
And it's, clearly as you start to study it, you start to appreciate the central role of the gut in not only absorption of nutrients, but really in the whole inflammatory process that we worry about, the immunologic process, the gut-brain connection, just so much that it's so rich, and it's much more than just this, hollow and solid organs that are involved in mechanically transporting, the gut fill that we generally been putting in. They're not even nutrients for the most part. So that's how I got interested in it. And I think that, I wanted to try to send a message to the conventional physician, population that, something, that we need to rethink the subject matter, and that rather than just giving another person the purple pill, that maybe we need to go beyond that. And that was really the basis for the book. And, you know, I think most, you know, many physicians who know me, you know, in other areas will pay some attention because it's a really very simple book. It's a very simple idea. And if we get more people, you know, buying into this, we can make a major change. And then, of course, the science caught up.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen with books like yourself.
Yeah, and the science caught up. I mean, you know, I think that's the other thing. You know, you were at a disadvantage, you know, in promoting concepts that you believe to be true, but which we would have viewed as not being scientific enough or not proven enough, so you can never prove things in medicine, you know. But I think that the literature over the last few years, the basic science and the intense, you know, literature has really caught up to the whole idea of the ecosystem and what these bacteria are doing. And there's not a day that goes by now where there's not a basic science discussion by leading scientists on the role of the bacteria and their impact on the body. I mean, just today on viruses and the bacteria, you know, it's a website that we've established at drstephenlamb.com, where I try to put in everything that's new on that website. I'm not selling anything. You know, this is just fascinating stuff.
Yeah. I remember going to a workshop many years ago, and Dr. Jeff Bland, who, of course, he was one of our actual professors when I went to Bastyr many years ago in the 80s. And he said that the total surface of your intestines is like a tennis court.
Oh, much more, yeah.
And he said if you steamrolled all that, you would have so much area that your body would have to do a multiple things for the gut, the function of the gut would have to do. So review with us the function of a gut. It seems like it's kind of paradoxical. It's supposed to let certain things in but keep certain things out. It's supposed to be like the airport security system. But go into detail with the listeners about the gut.
Sure. Well, you know, when we talk about the gut, I mean, you can actually, you know, if you want, you can think about it starting in the mouth and some of the enzymes that are released and the mechanical properties that start to break down your food. Remember, you're eating, I mean, most people think of the gut as a critical, important part for digestion, and it certainly is, although theoretically you could feed people intravenously, but you know, in reality we use the gut for breakdown of foods, and each food group and every food in combination needs to be broken down to a subunit that can be absorbed through the tiny openings in the intestines primarily, which is really the main area for absorption of nutrients, and I think that the body has been beautifully designed to orchestrate this mechanical and enzymatic breakdown of food so that you absorb a lot of the nutrients or whatever nutrients are already present in the food. Of course, if you start out with foods that have poor nutrient value, you can't extract very much from them. And by the way, I really think that that's a big, big problem.
It is. But that's a huge part of the whole picture.
But rather than writing another book about nutrition, you know, I figured let me take another angle and talk about the gut. But of course, as you know, if you put junk in, I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to get a lot out of it. But the gut is just insanely complex. Really insanely complex system that, you know, permits you to effectively break down fats, carbs, and proteins and also to absorb some vitamins in a way that if you have enough of these nutrients available that you can actually do well with. And I think it's and besides the nutritional part, the absorption of nutrients, you know, we have this entire other ecosystem of bacteria, you know, and fungi and viruses in the gut, primarily in the large intestine, that we have been, at least that I have been ignoring. I'm not saying you have been ignoring, right, but I have been ignoring, and most of us have been ignoring, because otherwise why would we be doing what we're doing to these bacteria? I mean, we're killing them. I mean, we're killing them every time somebody comes in with a virus. We give them an antibiotic, and all the antibiotics we put in foods, and the processed, highly processed, you're not feeding. I mean, you wouldn't feed a baby, you know, and expect the baby to develop if you feed the way we're feeding these bacteria. And so we're kind of treating the gut, the way the bacteria, the way we do the Amazon, you know, and we're just destroying it. And we never really appreciated that these trillions of bacteria must be doing something vitally important. And we just totally ignore them. We sort of thought that maybe they're just hanging around. As though, how's that possible? We don't have, you can't possibly have like all of this, you know, extra stuff in the body that dwarfs the number of cells that we have and has genetic information to think that these bacteria aren't doing something, you know. And it turns out that, you know, that these bacteria are helping to digest certain foods, are helping in the utilization of energy for the body, that the gut and the brain are communicating, you know, in a variety of ways. And one of these ways is really products that these bacteria are producing. And I think that, you know, we're starting to view the gut in terms of not only the digestive process, but the fact that it's kind of the first site where there is some introduction of foreign materials, foods, other products, and that the gut has to somehow react to these foreign products and decide what it wants to permit to penetrate and get into the body. And that's where the concept of leaky gut syndrome comes in, where people who are ingesting foods that are relatively toxic, you know, whether it's gluten or milk products or fructose corn syrup or, you know, whatever else we have generally in our foods, are now punching holes in these little tiny pores, and so permitting the entrance of stuff that the body shouldn't really be exposed to, causing issues in other parts of the body, like psoriasis or Alzheimer's or autism or heart disease, you know. And that, you know, although there is a little bit of a leap of faith in this, I think that there is an increasing, you know, awareness that the gut may actually be the cornerstone for the inflammatory and immunologic reaction that humans have. So I think that's pretty impressive.
Well, I'm looking at an article. I'm actually speaking at the Restorative Medicine Conference coming up in San Diego in the fall, and you know the name of my lecture is Gastrointestinal Associations in Rheumatic Illness, because I do a lot of work with Dr. Kamai in arthritis. We've written
right,
and here's an article: Current Opinions in Rheumatology, 1991. So, at UConn, which is where I live, I'm up near UConn here in Connecticut,
yeah.
It says, pathological changes in the abstract in the GI tract is associated with chronic complaints in multiple organs. In some instances, the association between GI pathology and diseases around the body is so strong that just the treatment of GI disease cures the patient of these extra-intestinal complaints.
Well, they were, you know, this is 91, and
yeah,
that's 20 years ago, and but I think that you know, when people were to look at it then, at least many of my colleagues, we wouldn't have even paid attention, you know. But I think it's
yeah, but this was published at UConn there.
Yeah, no, there's no question, but it just wasn't registering. Nobody,
yeah,
or at least fewer and fewer, you know, right, conventional physicians and patients were buying into this. And I think that, you know, all of a sudden you give somebody probiotics and their psoriasis improves, you know, a week later, they're going, is this really true? And the answer is, not in everybody, okay? And we may not really understand it in everybody, but it's starting to become very clear that there is something magical about taking really good care of your gut. And that includes, you know, one, making certain you feed the gut what makes sense, that it doesn't have to overwork in order to be able to, I mean, to break down. I mean, if a food's got a shelf life of 6 months, how is it possible for the gut to have the enzyme to break down that food? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So I think that we certainly do need to start by selecting foods for their nutrient value and making certain that they're foods that, you know, can actually be digested, and, you know, making certain that, you know, if you are, you know, intolerant of certain foods such as dairy products or gluten, you know, or that you maybe reduce or eliminate those foods from your diet. And then that you do whatever you can to promote, you know, healthy gut biology. And whether it's probiotics, prebiotics, digestive enzymes, which I think are really underplayed. I mean, I love this one company that you know, gave me this Digest Gold that's just beyond. I mean, I'm certain there are a lot of other companies that are excellent, you know. But I think that, you know, we really do have to start with with starting, you know, if somebody's really interested in wellness, let them start with the gut. You know, it's not about how much weights they lift and how much they can run and, you know, you start with the nutrients, you know, and start with your gut, and then you can move on to sleep and exercise
and
stress.
Well, if you can't digest protein, I mean, if you
can't
break your amino acids down, you fall apart. Your collagen falls apart. Your amino acids in your brain fall apart. You can't make glutathione, which I know you'll talk about the liver and the gut connection in a bit because I know you do a good job in the book with that.
Yeah.
So you virtually fall apart. You die. How could we be so obese and so malnourished? It seems
because
like an
obesity is obesity is our form of malnutrition.
Interesting.
And that's how you got to think about it, because we are calorie dense but not nutrient dense.
Hmm.
And I really think that that's going to destroy us as a country. And we worry about terrorism, but we have terrorism from within.
Yeah.
And it's the foods. I mean, it's just, if we don't somehow deal with this this epidemic of illness, really, of disease that is self-induced, then, as a nation, we're threatened. I mean, you can't have health care contribute 19% of the gross national product if the GNP only grows at a certain percentage. I mean, it's just... And we can blame the pharmaceutical companies, but they're only reacting to a need, okay? Yeah. They're responding to the obesity and diabetes and hypertension and high cholesterol. It's, you know, the general public really has to start to buy into being more responsible about their own level of wellness. And it starts with the nutrients, starts with the gut, starts with, you know, sleep, a whole host of things. And they asked me why I wrote the book, because as a doctor, you know, it gets frustrating, you know, for me just to continue to give people drugs and treatment for diseases that I've already convinced myself I can lower your blood pressure by giving you enough medicine and I can lower your cholesterol. But what am I really changing? Am I making you better?
Well, that's what happens. Healthier, right?
Yeah, healthier.
Well, tell us a little bit about the things that disrupt our gut. You know, we talked a little bit about certain things, but... And then how do people know that their gut's not working well? What are some symptoms they may have?
Yeah, very, very good question. I think that, you know, in general, you know, we view any kind of, anything that causes pain, you know, is a sign that something may not be working well. So, of course, if you're having, you know, let's put it this way, if you're even thinking about your gut, it's probably not working well. Okay, this should be effortless. So you shouldn't be waking up in the morning thinking, am I in a good mood or bad mood, right? You should, you know, if you're thinking about your mood, there's a problem with your mood, okay? if you're focused at all on your gut, you know, whether it's bloating, gaseousness, changes in bowel, bleeding, constipation, you know, if you're afraid to eat something, you have reflux, you know, you have acid coming up into your mouth, or you have a chronic cough that's been attributed to reflux. You know, if there's any kind of gastrointestinal, you know, issue that I just mentioned, it means that you're not having optimum performance. Okay, now, your gut may actually manifest, as you point out, with extraintestinal, you know, that you may be having joint pains, wrist pain, elbow pain, and you may not appreciate that some of it is really emanating from your gut. But, you know, that's be harder for the average person to figure out. But certainly any GI complaint, okay, would be an indicator that things aren't working in an optimum fashion. Things should be natural, and you shouldn't even be thinking about it, okay? So if you have reflux, if you have bloating, gaseousness, if you have, you know, changes in your bowels, of course, if you have anything more serious like bleeding, you know, if you're having weight loss and loss of appetite, of course, you've got a problem, okay? If you have belly pain, you know, or if you go to the doctor and it's obviously noted that you have abnormal liver function tests or you have some, you know, abnormalities with absorption of nutrients because your albumin is low or something,
right.
you have a problem.
And so when people, you know, have these kind of issues, and most of the times, a lot of times they go over the counter. I mean, I remember the days when some of these H2 acid blockers were prescription.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've moved them into over-the-counter, and
right.
I think people are abusing these.
Of course they are. Oh, no, I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, if somebody's not only on one of those pills every day of their life, and then on top of that they have the purple pill every day of their lives, I mean, these are prescription you know, drugs that really affect acid pressure. It just doesn't make sense to me. And people kind of use it, they don't use them just for a week at a time. They use them for years at a time.
Yeah.
And besides the cost, I just don't think it's a great idea. I'm not certain it's so healthy for you to be doing things like that. It just doesn't.
Well, I've seen bone densities.
Of course.
People been up that have been on these H2 blockers,
mm-hmm.
and they're terrible. Yeah, you know, you can't totally prove causation because there's many factors involved.
Right.
With that, but still, it seems highly suspect.
It doesn't seem reasonable.
It's creating like a chronic malabsorption.
Right.
And then when you malabsorb, who gets the free lunch? You're not getting the nutrients, but it's the dysbiotic bacteria. So maybe
mm-hmm.
you can tell us a little bit about this balance. Like, we have the good, the bad, and the ugly in
yeah.
our colon.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what we do have. I mean, we have a balanced system, or at least we're trying to have a balanced system. And, you know, it turns out that different populations, it turns out, maybe have different proportions of some of these bacteria that are living comfortably, hopefully, in your colon. It turns out, for example, that people with obesity compared to people who are not obese may have a different distribution of some of these bacteria. And, you know, whether it's cause or effect, we don't know.
Wow.
But it's starting to be appreciated that the type of bacteria that you have in your colon may be playing a role in certain vital areas such as metabolism, utilization of fatty acids.
Yeah.
And I think that what I see in the future, to tell you the truth, is the fact that there will be targeted probiotics for weight and for moods and for
other
things.
They're working on it right now.
Yeah.
I know Pharmax, the company Dr. Nigel Plummer is working on it right now.
Pharmax is a great company.
Yeah.
The HLC high potency, it's a very, very...
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I was taught by, you know, like the great Dr. Bastier and
yeah.
Dr. Pizzol, all these great naturopaths, and
right.
we would do this test where we would collect the patient's urine,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd put certain precipitants in the urine, and it would either stay nice and clear or go to blue, to dark blue, to indigo, to violet, to jet black.
Mm-hmm.
They call that the Indican test or
right.
the Obermeyer test.
Right.
And if you ended up with jet black, that means that your colon had so many nasty bacteria, fungi, yeast, other things in it that you were actually putrefying, and this was an actual direct measurement of the putrefaction products that were escaping the colon and getting absorbed into the bloodstream and then getting filtered by the kidneys, ending up in your urine.
You're
and this
exactly
was direct
right.
evidence to the patient that they were not following the doctor's orders.
Yeah, well, I think that's a beautiful, you know, way of looking at it. Progress is measured when progress is, you know, progress is made when progress is measured. So you can now actually see that. And, you know, physicians such as myself like those kinds. I don't do it, but it certainly would be something that I would be and I would like to do, okay? I think that what the bottom line is that what you're showing is some evidence of dysbiosis, that there's something not right. Dysbiosis is essentially sort of an abnormal balance of the bacteria in your body, primarily in your colon. But I think that they're going to find dysbiosis in all their organs. You know, I mean, if you have different amounts in your sinuses and in your and skin and your mouth,
right.
and they're all going to play a very, right now we're focusing on the gut, but we're going to find them all over. And right. and I think that, you know, we're going to start to very much pay attention now to this other system that lives within us, you know, and on top of us and besides us. And
it's like an organ. It's like an organ itself, almost.
Totally. It's absolutely. And I think that when I keep reading, as you're reading, you know, it just impresses me more and more on how, you know, the proper feeding and promotion of these gut bacteria is so vital to wellness.
Well, you talk about even on page 45 of your book, kids with autism, they found that when they eat wheat and dairy, the bugs in their gut created into this powerful hallucinogenic thing that makes them trip.
Yeah, well, they've shown, you know, there's, you know, that a lot of the kids, and I'm an internist, I'm not a pediatrician, so I don't see a lot of autistic children,
yeah.
But, you know, clearly in literature, the autistic children, which is a spectrum, obviously, it's not one condition,
right.
But, and there are a lot of factors, and we're not going to blame the gut bacteria on autism, but, you know, a lot of kids with autism have significant gastrointestinal complaints, very IBS-like complaints, and I think that parents have found that when you change their diet, their autistic behavior, they become less hyperactive, that they do better. And, you know, in the scientific studies, you know, you can show mice, you know, if you expose them to certain kinds of toxins where they absorb, I think it's propionic acid, it just agitates the brain, and they start acting the way an autistic child might act, you know. So I think that there is, you know, we're starting to look at, you know, a unification of diseases. That is, in the sense that, you know, one organ system isn't you know, isn't there by itself. It's got to interact with other organ systems, and you can't ignore one and think that it's going to have no effect. And
right, and the specialists don't seem to be talking to
themselves. Because they're focused only on one organ system, and I think that
right.
You know, when I was, you know, I never, even though I did special training, interestingly, in rheumatology, you know, I always wanted to be an internist. I didn't want to be the specialist. So when, you know, I was extremely well trained at Bellevue, and I was the director of the health service. I took care of all the medical students, but I think that I always liked the, you know, being the generalist, you know, as opposed, and so I was always able, I was not blinded by one organ system, you know, and I would look at, you know, you could look at the gums and think of heart disease, you know, you wouldn't think of just being a dentist, right? And I could think of, you know, and the heart is really just part of the endothelial function and endothelial, you know, and sexual function. So we help make the link, for example, between sexual health and overall cardiovascular health. And you know, the urologist can't do it and the cardiologist can't do it. You need people who are going to really look at the body as a whole to be able to make that link.
Yeah, we can't. So if you're just joining us, we're on with Stephen Lamb, and he's a physician that wrote this book, No Guts, No Glory, Gut Solution, the Core of Your Total Wellness. And he's a pretty well-known doctor. We see him on House Doctor on ABC's The View and other things like
that. Actually, I'm going to be on next Tuesday.
Great.
Talking about unnecessary tests.
Awesome. So, and I think we'll take a break. It's about half hour past the hour. Identify our wonderful network here, Progressive Radio Network. When we come back, I want to ask you some questions about what people can do. We've pretty much outlined the problem here, but I want to talk about enzymes and how do you rid the body of these pathogenic flora and how do you heal the gut and then how do you kind of maintain GI wellness over your lifetime. So stay with us, folks, right here at Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with Dr. Steve Lamb, author of No Guts, No Glory, The Gut Solution, The Core of Your Total Wellness. Now, welcome back, Doc. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of the gastroenterologists often, and I have just this morning I was on with three patients with ulcerative colitis, and they were saying, well, the GI doctor checked me for, you know, Campylobacter, Clostridium, Shigella, Yersinia, and I was clean. And I was telling him that, no, there are other bad bacteria that live in your intestine and yeast and other things like that that may cause disease. And what's your feelings about that and culturing the bowels, or how would a patient even know what their flora is like?
Yeah, that's a good question. In other words, what we look at, you know, traditionally would be causes for infectious diarrheas. And so you know that, for example, that if you have certain types of Salmonella or Shigella or Campylobacter, or you know, it may be the basis or the cause for a acute diarrheal illness. Somebody comes in and says, "I'm really sick. I'm bleeding. I'm having diarrhea," and you might culture these things out, and or C. difficile. You know, if you've given them antibiotics or whatever, but we don't test for the quote, the bacteria that are living within us, you know, in a quote, in a commensal in a comfortable way. In other words, we don't generally do a skin culture and say, oh man, you have stamp on your skin, okay? Because we expect certain bacteria to be living normally. We have millions and millions of bacteria in our mouths, okay? But
right.
We only test for strep, right? You don't test for all of the different, you know, anaerobes that you have in your mouth. And so the same way, we don't really test for the multiplicity of interesting bacteria that are living within our colon. And so the gastroenterologist is thinking in terms of the traditional pathogens,
right,
and not thinking in terms of the optimum bacteria balance, you know, in the person's colon. They're not testing for the traditional things, okay? And the reality is at this point, we almost don't have an ideal way of testing. I mean, you were talking a little bit earlier about the, you know, the urine tests for indoles. Well, it's those kinds of testing that I think might be helpful, okay, in trying to dissect out, you know, the optimum eco-balance. But we don't have it yet, you know,
right.
and that is frustrating. And so your response to this patient was, we're happy to see that you don't have the known pathogens that none of us should have, in all honesty, okay?
Right.
But we're talking about what is the optimum amount of bifidobacteria, lactobacillus, or other things that we're now starting to look at, you know, in the colon. And it just, we're just at the beginning, I think.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other question is, should people take probiotics when they're on antibiotics? So this is interesting because there's some patients that, you know, they spent $60 a bottle on these things, and when they take the antibiotics, it completely wipes them out, and I culture them, and there's nothing. But then there's some people that seem to benefit very much, and I'd rather put them on. I can't wait for medicine to start prescribing antifungals simultaneously when they prescribe antibiotics. I don't know one MD, conventional MD, that does that. I know a lot of alternative doctors.
The truth is, occasionally when you give a woman an antibiotic for a cystitis, you will give her a little Diflucan. So, but it's not routinely done.
Right.
Not routinely done. You don't give them Diflucan. You don't give them
how come? It makes common sense.
It does. No, it does. I agree with you. I think that a few weeks ago, JAMA actually came out, the Journal of the, you know, very conservative,
right,
that actually came out with, I think, supporting the use of probiotics in patients who were given antibiotics.
Ooh, I got to get a copy of that for my talk.
It was.
Thank
it was
you
good.
Very much for that.
It was about a month ago.
Okay,
so it was really the beginning of the observation about, 30% of people or so who give an antibiotic get some sort of, you know, GI dysbiosis. So I always use probiotics with antibiotics, and I'm trying to get everybody to use it even if they don't take antibiotics.
See, I tend to do, first I do, if someone's on antibiotics, then I do what I call, I do plantibiotics,
mm-hmm.
then I do the prebiotics, then mm-hmm. I do the probiotics, and I kind of do it in a sequential way, although
mm-hmm.
I'm finding that it's not, you know, the sequence can change in
mm-hmm.
many people, you know.
Yeah, I mean, once again, it's hard to measure what
right.
you're doing, and I think that's the dilemma. So, but I do think that the probiotics are really not going to be a complicated sell anymore. I think that, you know, the pediatricians are buying into the probiotics for...
Thank Jamie Lee Curtis for that.
You know, yeah, to stop or to reduce likelihood of certain diarrheas,
yeah.
you know. But I think that as we're starting to become very aware of these bacteria and their role in obesity and their role in other areas, I think we're going to find a much greater receptivity for them.
I think it's amazing because
yeah.
I remember the Dan and yogurt
point.
Commercials back
yeah.
in the 70s, and you know the there were 100 or so,
yeah.
and they were saying it's the yogurt.
It's a tipping point in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's what you're saying.
Now, what about healing the gut? So, say someone has irritable bowel syndrome, and the doctor says, "Oh no, I did a skin test, and you're not allergic to dairy.
Yeah,
you're not
yeah,
allergic.
Right, right.
You're allergic to dust mites and mold and."
Right.
There's no evidence.
Okay.
That you're
so there's
to
a
dairy
difference between right. So the answer is that when we test for allergy, we're measuring what is called an IgE reactivity. That is, we're looking at a traditional allergic reaction like you would to dust mites, okay? Mm-hmm. But what we're looking at in the gut more is a non-IgE type of reactivity, and it's not an allergic reaction in the traditional sense. It's not like, you know, you take in strawberries and you break out in hives, okay, or you develop what we refer to as anaphylaxis, or all of a sudden you have peanuts and you can die from it, okay? Right. We're really talking about, you know, a toxic reaction, an intolerance. And if you have celiac disease, okay, and you take in gluten, if you keep taking the gluten, you're going to continue to induce inflammation, and you're going to injure your villi, your intestinal absorptive capacity, and then ultimately you're going to get diarrhea and you're going to get other problems. But it's not a IgE reaction, it's a different kind.
It might be
of
G or M,
yeah, it could
or
be IgE,
A,
right,
or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, exactly,
yeah.
Which is not a traditional allergic reaction, but it's a toxic reaction.
So and the body's still reacting, though.
Totally, and yeah. It's doing...
I think that's what confuses patients.
And most of our reactions are not IgE. Most of the reactions we have are like if we have to an infection, is an IgM, IgG. I mean,
right.
It's not any of that. I mean,
exactly.
So I think we have to redefine, we have to really start thinking out of the box a little bit, and I think that there is, yes, a spectrum in which, yes, at one end you see celiac disease, which is, you know, severe malabsorption and diarrhea and you know, a biopsy which is really abnormal and, you know, malnutrition, and all of a sudden you take away gluten from the diet and the person is normalized. But there are a lot of people who have a gluten sensitivity that really can't be defined as having celiac disease, but there's no question that when you withdraw gluten from these people, that they are, you know, they can feel dramatically better, and their extra intestinal issues get better as well. So I think that, you know, there's, you know, a much greater sensitivity and awareness that it's not an all or none phenomena.
Right.
In conventional medicine, we try to make it all or none. Either you have heart disease or you don't. Well, the reality was that you weren't well a week before somebody tells you, you know, you have diabetes. So, you know, you may not have been able to be
made. Well, that's
out.
When you saw a syndrome, you know, that finally they developed a ICD-9 code for Syndrome X because medicine realized that it's a gradual decline, right?
It's a 10 to 20-year latency between for some of these chronic diseases. And so we're seeing that really across the board. And I think that, you know, the person who clearly is sensitive to gluten and dairy doesn't have an IgE reaction to that. It just, I mean, 70% of people can't absorb dairy, you know, as adults. I mean, it just... Of course they can. So, you know, they kind of, people live with it. You know, they have a little bloating and gaseousness. They don't make anything of it. You know, it's only when it's profound diarrhea that they kind of will realize that they'll develop an aversion to milk and dairy products.
Now, sometimes, like in The Lancet, again, in the 1990s, there were long trials in Oslo, Norway, by world-renowned rheumatologists who fasted people and then put
them
on like a vegetarian diet.
They got much
followed
better.
Them for 1-2 years and found out
much
that
better.
Their joint pain.
Of course, because what they realized was
what
that
does
the
fasting do, doctor?
Well, I think what it was is it was removing some sort of inflammatory inflammatory products, arachidonic acid, you know, prostaglandins, things that are being, you know, it was for example, the function of how much omegas you take in. You know, if you have a certain amount of omega-6s relative to omega-3s, you're producing more inflammatory prostaglandin-like molecules. And so when you change people's diet and you took away, reduced the body's capacity to produce these inflammatory toxins, the patient got much, much better.
Yeah.
There's no doubt. Eating less.
In one study, I'm reading this in Postgraduate Medicine 2007. It's just kind of serendipity that I had all this stuff right ready for the show.
Yeah.
But it says, is rheumatoid arthritis a disease that starts in the intestine? Question mark. A study comparing an elemental diet, maybe you can comment on that, with oral prednisone. And they found out when people followed when they got off of all the garbage in their diet and they chewed their food, by the way, that was a big thing that they found. People would wolf their foods down,
uh-huh.
and that first step of digestion, which is mastication, was missing, and that put strain on the whole body and blah, blah, blah.
I think is what you're saying. I mean, let food be your medicine, right? I mean, who said that? Hippocrates, right? So,
right.
And all of a sudden, food can also, it's not food anymore that we're taking in. We're taking in drugs. And the drugs that are masquerading as foods are toxic and injurious to our overall sense of well-being. I mean, you have to ask yourself, why is there an epidemic of obesity in the last 50 years? Although I'm a strong believer in genetics, the genes haven't changed, right?
Right, interesting.
There are
yeah.
other things that are happening, and so it's definitely related to lifestyle and the part of our lives that are dramatically different are the foods. I mean, the process, the way they're prepared, how we eat them, when we eat them. And so there's no question that inflammatory diseases, such as colitis, such as rheumatoid arthritis, such as lupus, such as heart disease, such as Alzheimer's disease, okay, all of these are being found to have this unified theory of inflammation, are going to be significantly affected one way or the other by how and what you eat. And the organ system that is involved with that process, which is the gut. And that's why I wrote No Guts,
book.
No Glory.
That's why you wrote your book.
Right.
No Guts, No Glory.
I mean, I wish I could tell you the kidneys are as important. They're just not, you know?
Yeah, and that tell us about that. So would you recommend that people kind of go on an elimination diet, or is there kind of like a boilerplate? Kind of stay off of whatever you eat, or
right.
do you want to? What I usually do for my folks is I keep them a food journal, and then I say, okay, let's find substitutes. Okay, you ate pasta, let's do rice or quinoa. You ate milk, let's do almond milk. You eat this, let's do that, and I kind of get them off of what they normally would eat for a while.
I agree with you 100%. And actually, I'm going to get your number later, okay, because we may be actually, it's very funny, you know, NYU has asked me to develop and work on a men's health center, you know.
Very good.
Because they consider me this big shot in men's health. But I think that, you know.
Well, one of my students, Dr. Espinosa, he's, I believe, does work at one of the places in men's health, too. So we'll talk about that off the air.
Yeah, off the air. Because great. I think that, you know, the concepts are we need, you know, every person coming into any center has got to have a proper nutrition, you know, assessment. And I'm not talking about how many carbs, proteins, and, you know, the stuff that we kind of waste our time doing, but really, really have a total understanding of how to eat, what to eat, and when to eat. You know, when you can feed, just think about that. If you could feed identical mice the same number of calories, but one in which you feed at the proper time and the others, you know, you feed at odd hours, and the group that ate at weird times had 45% more body weight, it's telling you it's not just about the calories, okay?
Like when you eat and how you eat.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether you're eating under stress or
right,
whatever.
Right, exactly.
Now, you said that the gut is like a brain. Tell us in a few minutes what that means.
Okay. Well, the gut, you know, the gut and the brain are like Siamese twins that have been separated at birth, you know. And, you know, the gut's got this enormous number of nerve fibers and serotonin. And, you know, it, on the one hand, it works independently from the brain. You know, you wouldn't want to bother the brain every time you were chewing food and swallowing and getting involved with digestion, you know, because the brain would then be cluttered, okay? And so the gut and the brain have a kind of a nice relationship. It's almost like a mother-daughter, you know. You know, you want them to be somewhat independent, but then there's still some interaction both ways, by the way. Okay, they can each annoy each other, and I think that that's what happens. In other words, when you take in something that is not proper, you get a signal into your brain to start to vomit. You know,
right.
And when the brain is stressed out and anxious and depressed, it sends signals to your gut, and that's why you have a lot of IBS. Okay, and so. I think that this gut-brain connection is very, very important. Certainly we know structurally you have the vagus nerve and that goes from the brain into your gut, but it's much more than that. And that's
If you had leaky gut, Dr. Lamb,
yeah.
Do you think that I've heard of like Dr. Doris Rapp, who wrote Is This Your Child, you know, on like ADD, and like she ties it in with food and chemicals, and she says there's a leaky brain.
Well,
interesting. The blood-brain barrier can leak these antigens through.
Well, I don't know if it can react. I mean, look, anything is possible. I mean, but I don't think it goes from the brain. I don't think the brain is leaking into the gut. I think it's the other way around. But, but look, anything is possible. It's just the way how you conceptualize this. But the reality is that, you know, the gut and the brain are communicating. And, you know, how they communicate, whether it's through hormones, chemicals, nerves, you know, but they're definitely communicating. I mean, why else would you, you know, as soon as you get anxious about something, it's almost instantaneous. You know, you feel a cramp in your gut. You want to go to the bathroom. Yeah. You know how quickly that is. You get a phone call, you get something. And so there's definitely direct communication. And I you know, we address that as well in the book. And we touch on a lot, hopefully a lot of very straightforward, you know, issues. We don't necessarily give people an eating program, and you know, but we do tell people, you know, here are the culprits. You know, look at the milk in your diet. Look at the the fructose in your diet. Look at the gluten in your diet. Maybe you want to try to reduce or eliminate them. Think about probiotics. Think about enzymes, which I really think is another great area. You know, cigarettes and alcohol, and don't ignore your liver. I mean, your liver is this enormously important detoxifying organ, and we're just filling it with fat.
Well, doesn't all the, you know, when I was taking anatomy, I asked my professor, why does all the 30 feet of intestines, both the small and large, why does it all tie into one gigantic vein, which is really literally the size of a garden hose, your portal vein?
The portal vein.
It went to the liver, and then it went to the rest of the body. What's going on here? I remember, of course, you made me research it myself. I shouldn't open my mouth, but I was always very inquisitive. So the liver has to be filtering,
of course,
stuff from the gut.
Absolutely, it's a very important filter, and it's like an air conditioning filter. Try to see what happens when your filter's clogged. See how effective your air conditioner works. You know, it's not going to be working. So, the liver now, we're just filling with toxins, with fat, with environmental stuff that we can't avoid sometimes, with medicines and. You know, you wonder why we're not in the great detoxification state. We're not. And so what happens is that if you starve yourself a little bit, you know, you reduce your caloric intake dramatically, you start sucking fat out of your liver is going to start to work a little bit better. And, you know, it's not surprising that your joints get better and that you overall feel better.
Well, that's what the old timers said, when in doubt, treat the gut.
Well, good. Well, they're right. They're right.
Well, tell us a little about where we can get your book
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, you can go to Barnes & Noble, go to Amazon, you know, go to the local store. You can get on your Kindle, you know, download the book. I really appreciate it. I think it's very helpful. DrStephenLamb.com is, I think, the
site. Now, what's the spelling of it? It's not L-A-M-B.
L-A-M-M. Yeah, L-A-M-M.
L-A-M-M.
Okay. Right, Stephen Lamb, L-A-M-M. And I think that you'll look at the website and you'll see it's very rich. It gives you, you know, all the stuff that I do. You know, I write a weekly column also for The Daily, by the way, which is an iPad app, and I have a lot of fun every Tuesday, so you can read the columns. You can follow me on Doc Lamb on Twitter, D-O-C-L-A-M-M, and you see all the stuff that I send out and write about.
Yeah.
But if you just get the book, I'd really appreciate it. I think you guys are going to really improve.
We also have some great resources, like if you're interested in getting some decent enzymes, it gives you
some companies I like. I love Enzymedica. I love Metagenics. I love Pharmax. You know, Digest Gold with probiotics is a very straightforward enzyme that I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of good companies out there.
And then some pretty good references, too, so that not making all this stuff
up.
No,
we're not making it up. Not making it up.
Is definitely science based on this whole thing.
Right.
Yeah. So why don't you leave with some parting advice to people about how they can take care of their gut. You know, I mean, we're getting to the 4th of July. People are eating hot dogs, hamburgers, salads,
things
like that.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is, look, you know, the gut is very forgiving. And, you know, if you just do a great job at least 80% of the time, you know, you're going to really be far advanced. And if you're looking for the secret to wellness, start with the gut is really what I'm talking about. And it's one of the easiest and simplest things you can do. And it's something that it's under your control. You control what you put into your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And as opposed to, you know, can't necessarily control where you breathe and stuff like that, but you can, and so make a difference. More fruits, more vegetables, more fiber, more organic stuff that it makes sense. And you know, 80% of illnesses can be prevented. And you know, we're going to go broke if we're just trying to treat illnesses. We're not going to make it.
Good probiotics.
Probiotics.
Maybe we could have a bitter salad, you know, and so I know in the old timers, my father like grew up in Italy, right? And
sure.
Before meals, he would take a swig of this stuff called Ferne Branca.
I know exactly what that is. Absolutely.
It's like these aperitifs.
Right.
And I would ask him, Dad, why are you taking this nasty stuff?
He goes,
it wakes up my stomach.
He's right. He's right. Well, now I'm going to see some patients. Thank you. But
okay.
if you have a chance when you're off the air, you have my phone number. Would you give me a call? I'd love to speak to you.
Sure. Great.
All right, my friend.
All right. Have a good
thank you.
Have
same
a good
to
day
you.
And thanks
my pleasure.
A lot. That was Dr. Stephen Lamb, No Guts, No Glory, and known by millions as the house doctor on ABC's The View, and right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we want to thank you for joining us for the program, and I'm going to beat it out of here a little area because we're getting hit by a major thunderstorm, and I don't really like to be on the phone and turn my computer off and things like that and chill out, but we really enjoyed having this time together to talk about health, wellness, and issues in alternative medicine, and we want you to stay healthy. On behalf of myself and Dr. Kamai, the natural nurse, we wish you the best, and stay tuned right here to the Progressive Radio Network. Bye-bye.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen, or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.